the letter of Jude is usually called in its history of interpretation the letter, the obscure letter, or the letter of Jude the obscure, because it is filled with a hard to penetrate and exceedingly colorful but very dark images and sayings, and no one's ever sworn to really understand it. It was written probably in the 70 or 80, and was ascribed to Jude, who by tradition was one of Jesus' brothers, James being one of his brothers and Jude being another. Usually scholars want to say the letter is pseudonymous. Now, do you know what pseudonymous means? It's a fancy word, which is when you write a letter to somebody, but you want to give it, you say it's from not yourself, because no one knows who you are, but you put it under a nom de plume, or an assigned name, like John Milton used to always address his tracts in the 17th century. He would say, this is a letter by, and he'd put some very strange Latin name as kind of a joke, because he didn't want to be identified the writer of the letter. It's a way to be kind of anonymous. Or Daniel Defoe did this. Or Jonathan Swift would write letters that were kind of sketches under assumed name. Now, this is these scholars are absolutely barking up the wrong tree, because who would in a million years want to get credibility by saying that your letter was from Jude, who no one had ever heard of? It's like saying, this is a letter from Dan Quayle. You know, I mean, it's about the same degree of credibility. Or Marilyn Quayle, you know, the whole idea that it would be very unusual for someone to choose Jude. Why not Paul or Peter or John? So the actual common sense thing is this was written by Jude, a man who was in fact the brother of James and probably related by blood to the Lord himself. And in this letter, he talks of a very tricky, difficult subject and situation in which he discovers that he can no longer kind of take the totally high road in talking about Christianity to the people to whom he's speaking, but he has to kind of get down in the trenches and deal with some difficult ethical issues or real presenting symptoms of life. And this letter has been a rebuke to me, and I've never preached on it because A, I'd never read it, and B, I wonder how many of you have, it sort of went against my philosophy, which was always to stay on the high road of Jesus Christ, the cross, the resurrection, the ascension, sin, the great facts of living in Christianity, and don't get involved with issues, because that's a dead end, and the world will just say, oh, these Christians always fight each other, and who wants to join them? And so take the high road. And Jude's letter is always a kind of, you don't want to read it if you believe that your life is always to be conducted at some kind of high level of dialogue, because he's very, very specific about a number of things. And this is what he says in verse 3. He says, "Beloved, I was eager to write to you about our common salvation, but I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith." What he means there is, I thought that I could just talk about the basic wonderful things we all have in common, but I found it necessary, verse 3, because Godzilla came to town. In other words, it was necessary because it was facing me right here. I found it necessary, though I didn't like it, to write appealing to you to contend for the faith, to actually get in there and struggle. Now again, it doesn't do me any good. I don't like that, but that's what it says. And I've been very riveted by the real example here, that why people in the church and outside of the church have to get involved with real issues is because of what happened in Nazi Germany with the church. You see, those people weren't terrible people, those Christian leaders. There were millions of them. They were just like you and me. They were faithful, normal church people. And very few of them liked Adolf Hitler. It was not a big deal. They did not like him, except for a few nuts. And the most majority didn't. And they kept saying to themselves, if we just preach the gospel and go about our mission, it will go away, or God will take care of it. And then one thing happened after another, and they didn't speak out about the controversial issues, and then Godzilla came to town. And when you meet some, I was able in Germany to meet some of the great saints who fought Hitler, because a lot of them did, we don't know it, but quite a few of them did, and end up in jail for a long period of time. And I said to these guys, golly, these are sort of Chuck Murphy types. I mean, these are tough, you know, angry, angular people. Do I want to be like that? But they were the ones, the tough, angular types, the squeaky wheels who fought Hitler, and history proved them right. God proved them right. They were on the side of the future, although at the time they were thought to be reactionaries. So I've discovered, partly from being there and meeting some of these toughies who were willing to go to jail under Hitler, and some of them to be killed, to discover that it is sometimes necessary to contend for the faith. This is not always Paul be on the high ground and just pretend it's not happening. And there are a lot of people even in our church, you know, even our presiding bishop wants to say that we just have to focus on the mission, and why do we get so worried about this, that, or the other thing? And he's got to read Jude, because Jude says, I wish I could write about it, but I found it necessary to contend for the faith. Now, are you with me so far? Jude wrote the letter, whoever Jude was. Secondly, he finds it necessary. Get down off your high, sanctified, theological, mission-oriented thing, and occasionally you have to deal with it. Not just because it's the church, but because it's in the world. Christians have to deal with Godzilla at the gate. Now, what is the Godzilla which has come to town for Jude? What is he talking about, actually, that he needs to contend with? Well, there are two fundamental problems that have afflicted Christianity in this period, and they are totally not new. He says this, admission has been gained, verse 4, by some who are ungodly persons who pervert the grace of God into licentiousness, and they deny our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. Now, this is very, very important. Now, why do you think Henry VIII resisted the Reformation? Henry VIII, until the day he died, resisted the Protestant Reformation. It took his daughter Elizabeth and his son Edward to prosecute it. Why did he resist it? Because he was afraid that if you tell people that they are loved by God despite their works, you will detach virtue from salvation. Let me repeat that. He was afraid that if they told the people that you are loved by God through the cross, notwithstanding what you do, that would somehow detach faith from virtue, and everybody would get licentious. Now, in actual fact, it doesn't work that way, but sometimes we see this happening. There is a guy in Washington named Michael Hopkins, who's an Episcopal clergyman, and he constantly guts on the internet saying, the Old Testament has been abrogated by the New, therefore we live totally under grace, and the entire job of the Christian community is to accept totally everything at all times. And that is an example of the perverting the grace of God into licentiousness, because what that misses is, and what Henry VIII didn't understand, the essence of the grace of God is first to recognize that you're a sinner. If you don't know that the grace of God is to you as a sinner who is a total mess, then you will in fact take advantage. But if you are confronted by the reality of your life as a sinner, you will not pervert the grace of God into licentiousness and will become a holier person. Henry never understood it. And Michael Hopkins doesn't want to understand it. But what this means is, when grace comes to you, grace says, you're a sinner not by virtue of what you do, but by virtue of who you are. And because God has substituted himself on the cross for who you are, you can therefore qualify for the inheritance of forgiveness. Now, let me repeat that. We think, being American people and being human beings, that sin is a matter of deeds. The Bible does not teach that. Sin is a matter of human nature. Jesus said that out of the heart comes fornication and lies and covetousness and gossip and sin. And Paul said, everyone has fallen short of the glory of God. No one has anything to crow about. We are all under sentence because of who we are. Now, do you understand how important this is? You may say to yourself, well, wait a minute. I'm the way I am. I can't help what I do if that's the way I am. Don't mess with who I am. Like Eminem. Eminem says, my art is who I am. So don't mess with who I am. Well, that's not good enough, Eminem, because the Christian faith is predicated on the fact that even as you are not good enough. It's your genes. You are a sinner as qua genetic psychological DNA. That's what sin is all about. We are who we are. Now, let me illustrate this. This is when people get this all messed up. I will say to Mary, that's the way I am. And just you have to accept that's the way I am and just deal with it. Get over it. And she does. But so I'm preparing this sermon, right? And I said, Mary, give me an example of some time when I say to you, that's just the way I am, get over it. And she says, no, you'll get mad. And so I get down on my knees and I plead, give me a dose of reality, of course, for the sermon. And she said, well, I'll give you an example. You say you hate chick flicks and you will not go to a chick flick. And I'm always asking you to go to some Jane Austen movie or something like that. And you'll never go because you quote, I just hate chick flicks. And then when you go, you always find something in it that speaks to you. You almost always find something that you're fascinated by and interested in. So it's just not good enough to say, I hate chick flicks. And I said, Mary, you're really getting where I live here. Now, let me give you another example. You say to yourself, well, and John Andrew talked about this on Friday. You say, well, I'm a morning person. That's just the way I'm a morning person. So I go to sleep at 8 o'clock. You like it or lump it, kiddo. I'm going to bed at 8 o'clock. Well, that's called sin. What do you mean, like it or lump it? I'm a morning person. What is that supposed to mean? Does that have any congruence with love and with sensitivity and putting somebody else before you? Or you say, this is just the way I am. I'm 75. And let me just tell you something. When you get to be 75, you have to just accept the way you are. And growing old gracefully means you just accept the way you are and other people just have to make way for you. And I say to the 75-year-old person, but I've never ever had the guts to say it, I say, that's not good enough. What do you mean? Just because you're 75, you can be a stone and be bitter and mean and cruel and selfish? Is that some excuse? Well, do you understand what this is? We pervert the grace of God into license because we don't understand who we are and we say, this is the way I am. Don't mess with my space. Just get over it. That's not good enough. You're a sinner whether you're a morning person or not. You're a sinner if you're a night person or not. You're a sinner if you don't go to chick flicks because you're selfish. Etc., etc. I'm saying that to myself. You've got to ask yourself, are you perverting the grace of God into license when you say, honey, this is the way I am. Son, when daddy gets home, he does not want to talk to a soul. He just wants to sit in front of the TV for 25 minutes and read the paper and do not interrupt me. I'm afraid that's not good enough. God will not be thrilled with your sense that you are a perennial guest on the Jerry Springer Show. He is not going to be thrilled. He will say to yourself, I don't care if that's the way you are. It's not right. Now, we're getting somewhere. And therefore, the whole movement to say that if this is the way I am, God accepts me, is based on a superficial and non-biblical understanding of the human predicament. It's not what I do. That's bad enough. It's who I am. Now, then he comes, the next thing is related. So you see, there are people or ways of thinking that pervert the grace of God into an excuse for being an S.O., you know, for being a not nice person, licentiousness. And, he says, they deny our only Master and Lord Jesus Christ. Now, they're linked because, you see, Christianity is hinging on the unique revelation of Jesus Christ that is in no other religion and is absolutely and totally linked to one historical fact. Now, wait a minute, you may say, getting a little briarwood here, hold the phone, let's leave it broad, leave some loose ends, Paul. Well, let me say why we believe that Jesus Christ is the only way to God. We believe this because all other ways to God are uncertain and do not have a complete atonement for my DNA. See, I've got to have someone stand in the place of my DNA, my tilt, my orientation, my perspective, the way I came into this world, my mother, my father, my children. Someone's got to stand in the place not of what I do, but who I am. And we have only seen that in the death and atonement of Christ. This is the absolute center of all religion. Otherwise, I'm in a fog. Is God really nice? Well, the weather tells me no. Is most of the time. Is God benign towards me? My life experience tells me mezzo mezzo. Is God really active in my children's life in a benign way? Come see, come sub. Yes one day, but no another. I am a mystified person had it not been for the one Lord Jesus Christ who died for me, gave himself for my bod, my whole DNA, and therefore showed me a God of caring. Now, let me tell you something. Everybody talks about Thomas Jefferson here. Thomas Jefferson was the great architect of religious pluralism and separation of church and state. Well, people only publish what they want to publish. Do you know what happened to Thomas Jefferson at the end of his life? I mean, it's a matter of record. At the end of his life, he changed his mind. He didn't have a conversion, he didn't have a deathbed conversion, but Thomas Jefferson started in his presidency attending Christ Church, Georgetown, which is an ancient Episcopal church, old Episcopal church in the Georgetown, towards town, across Wisconsin. And he started attending this church in his presidency every Sunday, and this was a shock for a lot of people. And one man came up to him, and it's a well-recorded incident, and said, "Mr. President, how can you attend the liturgy when you yourself have said you don't believe a word of it?" And he said, "I have found out that the wellspring of all virtue is in the Christian religion. And therefore, as president, I must set the example of going to an Orthodox church every Sunday." Calling the ACLU, you know, what is this? It was the Library of Congress that put it in a book just last year. I have it. I'll show it to you. Jefferson changed his mind in light of the inability for his previous school of thought to give virtue to the world and to society. And so he went to the Church of the Master and Lord Jesus Christ in all the final Sundays of his life. And that is not disputed, but of course no one wants to write about it because it doesn't back up your case. Well, what this means is that the reason we've got to not deny the unique saviorhood of Jesus is I've got somebody to stand in for my DNA. I've got to have it. If I don't have it, I'll be in a terrible way. Mary was saying a wonderful thing. She said, "Thank God the Bible teaches that God is fair." And I said, "You think that's good news? I think that's terrible news. I'm counting on him to be unfair. It's the only thing I have. I'm counting on him to be merciful, because if he's fair, then I am really in trouble." It's like when you get a really fair judge. Do you really want one? Tell me. There are a couple. Do you really want a fair judge? Well, I don't want one at that particular moment. Because I need to have a judge who has made it his business to stand in for my DNA. Let me wrap it up. First, we cannot live in some kind of plateau of cloud cuckoo land and say, it's all right, it's peace where there is no peace. So I'm willing, at this point in my ministry, to get down and fight for that which is important, not just for the sake of the church, but for the sake of the world. Secondly, what is Jude talking about? He is talking about people who have misunderstood that grace is to the human being qua ontology, not qua consequence, but qua the whole nine yards. And that is so powerful. When I get a little grasp of the fact that just because I don't like chick flicks, I'm going to be a terrible, unhappy, unhelpful, unempathetic, and basically narrow husband, I need to get face to face with that fact to love. And the funny thing is, it's not going to make me less loving. It's going to make me a trillion times more loving. We actually saw a chick flick last week, and I was mesmerized. Now, point two. And the final thing is, this is why we cannot deny our only Master and Lord. The Lord Buddha is inscrutable. He is inscrutable, profound but inscrutable. I've been studying his smile for 49 years, and I've never gotten a clear answer. And God knows you do not want to deal with Allah unless you have really gotten it together in the little things. And therefore, I have got to have the one who substituted for me, the only one I know of, Jesus Christ on the cross, and that's why he's the only one. And if you take him away from me, and if you say he's not the only way, I am on a lifeboat like that painting by Delacroix. Remember that painting of all the people on the lost boat, and they're looking for help, and no one sees, and they're all being sharks around them? I am one of those naked, starving, thirsty, going out of my mind with salt water poisoning, people on a raft, it was called the Medusa, in the middle of the ocean, looking for some. And if you tell me that he's not the only way, all I've got is a lot of bogus, false empty, inscrutable, weather channel oriented, parasitically mercurial possibilities. So Jude has something vital to teach you. Take this in. When you go home, if you find yourself saying, this is the way I am, get over it. God will never say such a thing to you. And secondly, thank God that because you in fact are the way you are, that we have one Lord and Master. And Jude will put us right in the hot seat like it's nobody's business. Bring your friends in the next 4 weeks and prepare to do business with God.